Good afternoon. I'd like to call the House State Affairs Committee to order. Today is Tuesday, April 2nd, 2024. Let the record reflect the time is 3:05 p.m. Today we have President Vice Chair Wright, Representative Carpenter, Representative Carrick, Representative Story, and myself, Chair Shaw. I'd like to remind the committee members and those in the audience to silence or turn off your cell phone, please. The staff assisting us today are our regulars, Annie Goodenough with House Records and Talia Ames with LIO, and my staffer, Reese Williams, will be our committee aide. There are three items on the agenda today. We'll have an initial introduction and presentation of House Bill 330, Restrict Prisoners' Access, Digital Devices, sponsored by Representative Vance. Following that, we will continue consideration of HB 228, Mental Health Psychedelic Medical Task Force, sponsored by Representative Armstrong, and HB 190, Alaska Sunset Commission, sponsored by Representative Carpenter. And I think we may be holding that today, but we'll get to that. Any members have any comments before we start? Okay. House Bill 330, Restrict Prisoner Access to Digital Devices, sponsored by Representative Vance. This is the bill's first hearing. Today, the bill's sponsor and her staff are here, as well as representatives of Viapath, to walk through the legislation and give a demonstration. Representative Vance, Mr. Bob Ballinger, welcome. Please put your come forward, put your names on the record, and begin your presentation and demonstration, please. Thank you.
For the record, my name is Representative Sarah Vance. I represent House District 6 of the Lower Kenai Peninsula, and this is my policy advisor, Mr. Bob Ballinger.
Bob Ballinger from Representative Vance's office.
So, Mr. Chairman, this is one of my bills that takes on a lighter note, and if there was a better title, I think it would be creating opportunities for education and connection. However, it is House Bill 330 that restricts digital access to prisoners. It's a common sense and impactful approach to correctional reform. Current research highlights a significant gap in access to education and programming among incarcerated individuals, attributing to constraints like limited classroom space and staffing shortages. Leveraging technology such as computer labs and tablets can effectively address these challenges, amplifying the efforts of instructional and rehabilitative staff. By authorizing institutions to provide restricted tablet access for education, reentry, and essential life purposes, while also prohibiting their use for other purposes, this legislation extends opportunities for successful reintegration into society, reducing the likelihood of future criminal activity. Preparing prisoners for successful reentry into communities is not soft on crime. It is sound public safety policy. House Bill 330 recognizes the pivotal role of education in breaking the cycle of criminal behavior. By facilitating access to limitless educational and programming resources through tablets, the bill prioritizes the state's long-term goal of reintegrating individuals as productive and law-abiding citizens. Investing in education and rehabilitation through technology isn't about being soft on crime, it's about addressing the root causes of criminal behavior and preventing recidivism. Next, we have a short video that illustrates the benefits of delivering programming through digital access, and it addresses challenges faced by nearly all correctional facilities. In collaboration with Amazon, DC Jails established a cloud practitioner certification program, demonstrating the potential for similar initiatives in Alaska. This is just one example of the opportunities that would be available to the Department of Corrections. Virtual classrooms are monitored engagement that could optimize educator and clinician resources, enhancing rehabilitation efforts. So we are going to look to see if this video will play where it wasn't able to come up in the PowerPoint, so we'll see if it can go.
And I don't know if Buddy's around or if Stafford can show me where to pull it up because I've lost it.
Will it go in the PowerPoint?
No.
A brief at ease.
Hello. I'm Xavier and I'm from Maryland. I got into the APDS AWS college certification program by being on an educational unit. It was something that one of the programs they offered, and they said, hey, it's a pilot program coming through a partnership with APDS and Amazon. I was interested because I knew I'm technology. I've always had a real strong pull towards anything technological. Before I started this program or having access to the APDS tablets, I would say that those were the darker days.
Oh, man, what do I stop? It's a bunch of stuff on the tablet, like other people's stories on the tablet, like Chris Wilson and AWS, Amazon Web Services. I never would have ever thought, like, because I graduated college, but I didn't spend much time on the computer. The most I've ever done with the actual electronics part, like an iPad, putting music on it, typing a paper, video games, hooking up to the internet, like, that's really it. Now, I'm learning about cloud computing, where you could use another person's servers, and from there you can pick what type of, how much space you want, and how much compute space, and RAM you want to use, like, stuff. I'm using terminology I've never even known without this tablet or this opportunity. So, it's a whole different world for me.
The biggest lesson I've learned on that is discipline. So it's, I've had to be very disciplined about how much time I spend, what I can learn, how I can teach others. Because I find myself with a lot of my time spending helping other people out with this. There has been a lot of community building, so I find myself working one-on-one with people or in a group environment where we're going over test questions and ideas and bouncing ideas off of everybody else and making it a part for everybody to be involved in.
Like I say, this is my first time ever having access to something like this. And some information and things that's only going to do that. It consumes my whole day. I wake up and grab the tablet. I go to sleep and use the tablet.
It's laid out for the layman. Like, you don't have to assume you know nothing, you know. And I can say that I've been impressed at the level at which our class has went from a knowledge of nothing to we're having competent conversations about the technology.
You got more opportunity. And I would say better too, because the earning potential is just limitless.
The program was completely free and was taken care of by between partnership of EPDS and any agreements.
By the program being free, it gives people the opportunity to participate in the program. Most people really, really don't get a lot of money, and most people come from poverty. The family don't really have money. We don't have money. If you work, you probably don't get paid nothing but $26 a month in jail. So, the person who had to eat and pay for education, probably. I'm really appreciative for the opportunity here. And all the thoughts they put into this just to give us everything that they have on it, they really give us way more to do. Instead of just sitting around waiting for court, you're really empowering yourself and bettering yourself. Rather than, of course, the books is one thing, but the books on this type, but this AWS is something different. You really can. You really are bettering yourself in a way that you probably didn't before. It's teaching you way more than any book actually ever could.
Participation in correctional education programs significantly reduces the risk of recidivism. Research consistently shows that inmates engaged in such programs are 28% less likely to reoffend compared to those who do not participate. Individuals enrolled in post-secondary education programs are 48% less likely to be reincarcerated than those who do not pursue further education. Research indicates that gainful employment post-release significantly decreases the likelihood of recidivism. Investing in skills development during incarceration not only beneficial for individuals, but also for the community as a whole. Among those incarcerated, 57% express a desire to participate in educational programs, yet barriers such as limited opportunities remain prevalent. A significant portion of inmates have never been offered the chance to engage in educational programming. 70% of prisoners express a desire to participate in academic programs, indicating a strong interest in earning certificates or degrees from colleges or trade schools, and the desire is to do more. For every dollar spent on correctional education, $5 is saved in 3-year reincarceration cost, equating to a 400% return on investment. House Bill 330's emphasis on equipping individuals with knowledge and skills not only enhances public safety, but also yields substantial financial savings, making it a prudent investment in societal well-being. Further, this bill has no fiscal note. This legislation does not mandate the use of technology. It only allows it, and there are also ways for DOC to defray the potential costs of technology. While much of this presentation has emphasized the opportunity for education, I want to say that it also provides a way for individuals to connect with their legal counsel and with their families. And that, as we've seen during COVID, there were heavy restrictions on access by family members to the incarcerated persons. And this had a great impact on their ability to be to continue and be able to meet the requirements that were put on them by for those seeking probation. Most of the individuals that are in our prisons are going to reenter society into our communities. And when we offer them more opportunities for education, for the ability to be able to get jobs and have an easier process reintegrating into the community, then we have done our job on rehabilitating those individuals to be productive working citizens again. In conclusion, House Bill 330 represents a vital step towards effective correctional reform, recognizing the transformative power of education in reducing recidivism and promoting successful reintegration into society. We are accomplishing this by amending AS 33.30.015 to allow the use of a tablet to facilitate the prisoner's rehabilitation, reentry, case plan, employment, education, vocational training, access to legal reference materials, visitation, healthcare, and for another purpose identified by the commissioner in regulation. It also prohibits its use for any other purpose like entertainment, social media, social texting that many in the public would have concerns about. By leveraging technology and prioritizing access to educational resources and reentry, this legislation offers a pathway toward a safer and more prosperous future for both individuals and communities. I want to thank the chairman for the opportunity to bring this forward, esteemed members of the committee for your thoughtful consideration. I do have invited testimony who can give a personal account of a family member with the use of a tablet. And then after that, have a bit of show and tell. We do have a tablet that members can have your hands on with someone here that can describe what the process is and answer any questions. But first, I'd like to go to our invited testimony, Philip Licht.
Thank you, Representative Vance. We'll start with Philip Licht, President and CEO of Set Free Alaska. If you'd like to introduce yourself and make your presentation, please.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Rep. Vance. Appreciate you having me here today. And I would like to speak to this from two different levels. One, as mentioned, for the record.
Could you introduce yourself, please, your name?
Yeah, for the record, my name is Philip Licht, and I am the President and CEO of Set Free Alaska. I'd like to speak to the benefit of individuals in the context of the programming that we offer, as well as a family member of an incarcerated individual. We provide services for people coming out of the correctional institutions, substance abuse, mental health. We actually have a contract with the Department of Corrections to provide services within the facilities as well. And what I've noticed, which I think just anecdotally backs up some of the research that's been stated by Rep. Vance, the more disconnected that people come from family, from community, from normal life, so to speak, the more difficult it is to reintegrate them back into society and to help them become contributing members, and the more likely that they are to commit new crimes when they get out, thus perpetuating this cycle we're all trying to solve. And so I'm a strong proponent of educational opportunities and rebuild, like while we're serving the purpose of DOC, one of the purposes is keeping people safe, and providing some consequences for actions. If we can do anything we can do to rehabilitate individuals is going to help them reintegrate. And the more they can stay connected, especially with family, and pursuing things that we all want to better ourselves. It just really helps as we start to work with them on the outside, helping them rebuild their lives. We see a lot more success when we're able to do this. And it's a limit. As a treatment provider, we're very limited inside the walls because of these technology barriers, even in providing the service, which is probably a different topic, but it's sometimes a challenge providing the service because of some of the technology limitations within the institution as the provider. My little brother has been incarcerated in Alaska, and he's now currently incarcerated in the state of Arizona. This is, I believe, the third institution he's been at in Arizona. And he has a tablet down there. And I'll tell you, as a family member, and I know for him, the benefit of us being able to communicate with him through this tablet. He was able to do calls before, but the challenge of these calls, the wait time, then it just always seemed difficult to be able to communicate with him. We can communicate with him on the tablet through text, which is something that it sounds like was maybe limited through this, but it's all through a secured provider, and we can communicate with him through email. And just for us as a family to stay connected to him, to encourage him, he's also able to pursue education, and there's a lot of resources that he can access through it. And so it's been a real benefit and a blessing for our family, and I know for him. And I'll say, I don't know how it's set up, structured financially in the back end, but we are the ones who pay. We pay money to be able to... the text messages cost a certain amount, the e-messages, they call them, cost a certain amount, and it's facilitated by what looks to me to be a third-party contracted provider. Securus is the place that we go through, but it's super smooth and easy, and we pay, which is a burden to us as a family, which is fine because of the benefit that we get from it. It doesn't seem to me like, you know, that cost is being incurred, maybe a joint cost, but something we don't mind doing. So it's been a great benefit for us. I know he's encouraged being able to talk to us. And as a provider of treatment services too, this is something I think could really benefit our state and our providers as we're trying to help people reintegrate as they come back out. So again, I appreciate the time. I'm willing to answer any questions. I have really honestly only experiential, testimony regarding this. I don't have a lot of details on how it operates, but it's been positive for our family, and I think it could be positive for the inmates here in our state as well.
Thank you, Mr. Lick. John Pilchner from ViaPath, would you put yourself on the record and provide your testimony, please?
Mr. Chairman, with your permission, we have a tablet to pass to members as he gives his presentation.
As he's given his presentation, all right. Okay, Mr. Pilchner, go ahead. Introduce yourself.
Yes, sir. Are you guys able to see my screen if I share, or... Would you just want me to talk to it?
We're passing the...
Let me see.
Let's take a brief of these. Back on the record. Mr. Pilchner, go ahead and introduce yourself and provide your testimony, please.
Can you guys see my screen there? You said yes?
Yes, we can.
Okay, perfect. Sorry, my name again is John Pilcher. I'm the Associate Vice President of Sales Engineering with ViaPath. I handle a lot of our presentations for larger DOC accounts and also larger counties. What you're seeing right here is the screen that the incarcerated individual would come to whenever they get ready to log into the tablet. And as you can see with those tablets being passed around, this is not a standard off-the-shelf tablet. It is one that we have built specifically for corrections. The everything from the hardware, the software, and everything on it is built with security in mind, just because we know the environment and the clientele we're going to be handing these to inside the correctional facility. So as you can see, my login screen here, it's simply the offender's PIN would be put in. With that, you'll see it's going to pop up and take a photo of me. What we're doing with that is just having a photo on file for the DOC facilities to be able to go back and look and see who actually was that logged into that tablet for that given time. This would be their secondary or security PIN, and this is just to help kind of cut down on other inmates utilizing their, taking another inmate's PIN and try to log in into the tablet. Another way for the facility to communicate with the inmates is this here with, as you can see, is my inmate handbook. This could be an inmate handbook. It could be a COVID notification, a PREA notification, any type of PDF document that the facility wanted to post out to either a single facility or multiple facilities across Alaska. You guys have the ability to go in and update that. And you can see here, I actually have to open that document and acknowledge that I've read it before I can move forward and do anything onto the tablet. As we move forward a bit here, this will bring me into my profile page. You can see we can have everything from phone calling to certain free profiles for indigent inmates to be able to access. We've got some education profiles in here, and that's kind of what I'm going to gravitate to and go in to for this demonstration. So as we go into that, the education profile, you'll see here a lot of different things like you heard mentioned before, expanding that access out for educational content for the incarcerated individual while they're inside the facility, as well with our learning management system that is also available to the inmate once they're released from the facility. So they would still have access to be able to go in and continue that content, because the last thing we want to do is stop their education process just because they got released from the facility. So again, they can continue that. They can go in and access any of their different certifications or documents that they may have accumulated over their time while they're incarcerated, and have that to be able to go for a job interview or something like that. A few other things you may see on here are some of the job posting applications or job posting sites. We can either connect that out to some of the local job posting groups that you guys may use in the state of Alaska, or we can use some content such as like Honest Jobs to reach out and have them to be able to utilize and be able to communicate out with. Just to kind of give you an idea what that education app looks like as well, when you pull this up, you'll see it's kind of, it could be either a self-paced education environment or a teacher and student environment where teachers can actually assign that content out to the inmates and then they can utilize that and go in and access it. Also, too, in respect to communication, we've got things, I know it was called texting before, but we called electronic communication. So essentially what that is like I said, it's a secure environment where friends and family and the offender can communicate back and forth, and it's all monitored and controlled by the facility. No app can be put on this tablet without DOC approving that, and you guys actually posting that out to the tablet. So there's no true internet access for them to be able to go in and get to and you know, try to get out to a Facebook app or something like that. It's only the secure content that the DOC is approved for them to be able to go in and access. As well, too, video visitation was talked about. Again, with that, it is a secured internal system that we have where it is all monitored by the facility, or the recordings can be accessed by the facility to go back and take a look at. But again, it does increase that communication with being the e-messaging or being the video visitation. It allows them to have that extra communication and have that extra contact with their friends and family members. Felicia, do you have anything you want to add to that? And if not, I'll kind of open it up for questions.
Sure. Just really quickly, JP, Felicia Hall for the record, with ViaPath Technologies. Just going to add to John's presentation that, again, I think he's covered the educational content, again, that's readily available through the use of the devices. And, you know, one of the things that we want to make sure you understand that is the educational, the vocational, family reunification services, the substance use and mental health treatment services, telehealth, and also communication services. So these devices really serve as a force multiplier for correctional systems. And we know across the industry that systems are understaffed, and they have instances where volunteers or program coordinators or program servicers aren't able to come into facilities. Well, through the use of these tablets that serve as all-inclusive devices, you can still make sure that your incarcerated population can still have the benefit of those services directly at their fingertips. And so it does really serve as a force multiplier. And one of the things that we've seen is that while ultimately you might be using them initially for communication services, I think the representative mentioned very well that, again, making sure there's a pathway for rehabilitation and reentry is most important, to make sure that they have access to all of these resources while they're incarcerated, but also continuing into community to make sure they can continue that programming. So that's it in a nutshell. Definitely hope, happy to answer any questions that you all might have. The security of these devices are key. One of the things that we talk about is to make sure we have a very safe and secure network to make sure that we do offer these services on, so you don't have to worry about the nefarious content or nefarious conduct happening by trying to get out to intimidate witnesses, trying to get out and open the world wide web in a way that just a free world user would do so, but that these are locked down devices only able to be used under the authority of the DOC and the third party that's offering the services to the Department of Corrections. So with that, we can open up the floor for any questions you might have for our team.
Thank you, Ms. Hall. Mr. Pilcher, any questions from committee members? Representative Wright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, I believe this is for the folks who just did their presentation. You spoke about the devices being locked down, and I think I heard earlier that folks can contact each other on the device, contact family members. Is it programmed numbers that they can contact message-wise, or is it just something that they can ask for somebody's number to be added to it, or how does that work?
The friends and family can request contact with an offender on the within the DOC, and then the DOC staff actually has the ability to either approve or disapprove that particular communication, whether that be messaging or whether it be video visitation, much like we can do with the phone calling.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Carrick.
Mr. Chair, I think my question's actually for the department, so I can wait.
All right, thank you. Representative Story.
Thank you, Co-Chair Shaw. Chair Shaw, sorry about that. And mine might be for the sponsor, too, because we had said there wasn't a fiscal note. So does the Department of Corrections have these tablets right now in our facility?
Through the chair, Representative Story, they have been this would not be a cost incurred by the state. They could contract, and there's a variety of means that they could utilize, whether it's paid for by the inmates and their families or with other services like the Amazon services, for instance. But I believe we do have them available to answer more specifically.
Okay, thank you. I'd love to hear how the Department of Corrections could use this. Thanks.
Do you want to change out the seats? And we'll just bring Corrections up here and answer that question. Thank you. Just give us your name and answer the question, if you would, please.
Good afternoon. My name is April Wilkerson. I am one of the deputy commissioners for the Department of Corrections. Through the chair to Representative Story, we currently have a pilot program operating at Highland Mountain Correctional Center, and so we do have about 350 tablets at that facility right now. It's very limited. Right now, it's only attorney-client approved, and then we are working with the parole board to connect the parole board onto ViaPath for those parole hearings to reduce some of the travel costs associated with parole hearings. And then we're continuing to work with the courts to deploy the court hearings on the tablets. We also have, I think, a limited 5 or 10 court-issued tablets at Goose Creek Correctional Center, where there are video court hearings occurring between the population and a couple of the courts in the northern area.
Follow-up?
Yes, thank you. And I'm very excited about this opportunity to expand it. And so through the chair, it sounds like by what will this having this internet access mean to the Department of Corrections?
Through the chair to Representative Story, thank you for that. Depending on how the legislation is finalized, Our hope is to generate efficiencies and expand the capabilities of programming, whether that's education, substance abuse, other treatment, mental health. We are also hopeful to deploy the telemed and utilize telemedicine through these. In FY23, we had just over 5,000 individuals that were transported outside of an institution for medical purposes. If we can reduce that by utilizing telemed, that is going to generate a reduction within the department. Long-term, what we hope is that we can offset some of our manual processes. Maybe mail can be deployed utilizing the tablets instead of the print and deliver. We're copying all of the inmate mail currently. If we can deploy that utilizing the tablets, that would be an efficiency within the institutions. Another avenue that we are hopeful of is we have an RFI, a request for information. So currently, if an inmate wants to seek services or information, they get a piece of paper, they handwrite out their request, it goes in a box, a security sergeant will come by, pick up all those papers, go deliver them into somebody else's mailbox, somebody else will go and collect them, provide a written response, they go back into a box, a security sergeant will go pick them up and then go deliver them back. If we can convert that into an electronic process where an inmate is able to get onto their tablet, generate an RFI, request for information, and it goes electronically, whether it's medical, dental, behavioral health, to the superintendent for security purposes, for their inmate banking accounts, it would generate an efficiency and alleviate some of that manual process that is done currently within the institutions. Those are just some of the efforts. Of course, video visitation is one that we would like to pursue, but we have a lot of options available to us.
Follow up. Since you've been doing it as a pilot project, how have security issues, any have arisen, any concerns that you've had with that?
Through the chair to Representative Story, I want to correct myself and back up a little bit. We have 6 current active tablets. We are hopeful that the 340 tablets are deployed by the end of the month. And this has been a really extremely slow rollout to ensure the security is maintained within the institution.
Follow up. Can you tell me a little bit more about security? And maybe it's someone online or someone else who can talk about that.
Yeah, this is John Pilcher with Viapath again. So the security on the tablets, like I said, the hardware software itself, the actual software on the tablet, is our own custom operating system, custom ROM. It is Android-based, but it is built specifically by Viapath for corrections. So there are none of those underlying apps that the inmates can go in and access. And also, as well, with the wireless security. So these are Wi-Fi-enabled tablets, not connecting out to a standard cellular network, but internal wireless that Viapath comes in and installs. The entire wireless infrastructure that we put in place is secured as far as down to the point of only allowing our tablets to be able to access those hidden SSID, as we call it, or access points. So it does, in a sense, lock down that tablet. So only that tablet can connect into that facility. Only individuals that have inmate pins that are registered in the system can log in. And like I said, the hardware itself is secured as well.
One more follow-up, if I might.
A follow-up.
Thank you for that, Chair Shaw. My other follow-up would just be learning more about the educational components and who does provide some instruction on that for the people wanting to get more skills.
So this is Felicia Hall with Viapath. So we have a gentleman who runs our educational services, Tony Loudon, is our chief solutions officer for the company, and he runs those services for us. But with that, we have partnerships with third parties that provide educational content, and Viapath has its own learning management system as well that makes available evidence-based programming thousands and thousands of courses being offered through the learning management system, as well as through Adovo is a partnership that we have, Adovo, as well as CipherWorks. And they have a catalog of programming that's available, like I said, for vocational services, for educational services, and a myriad of other genres that are covered from an educational standpoint. So you can get everything from your, you know, GED or HiSET certificate all the way up to, you know, HVAC, carpentry, and all of those other vocational type services. We have partnerships across the basis, and all of those partnerships, again, are vetted very carefully and cautiously to make sure that we're only offering very robust educational services and, again, evidence-based practices being made through corrections. We currently service about 22 departments of corrections and are doing services with those entities being made available educational services through our tablet platform.
Any additional questions from committee members? Representative Carrick.
Thank you. Through the chair to Ms. Wilkerson. Is visitation in DOC facilities back to pre-COVID levels?
Through the chair to Representative Carrick. Yes, they are.
Okay, follow-up.
Follow-up.
Is the current methods for visitation either in person or over the phone? Are those kind of the two ways currently incarcerated individuals are able to connect with friends or family?
Through the chair to Representative Carrick, yes. So there's two types of visitation. There is in person, and then you can go in through a panel, a plexiglass, and have a phone call, or via telephone through our Securus platform currently.
And follow-up?
Follow-up.
Is there a cost to utilizing the phone call system for inmates currently?
Through the chair to Representative Carrick, there is. So currently, inmates do pay for the phone calls. We have had in place since COVID. We've worked with Securus, and 4 free phone calls are provided per week. And then indigent, we have a requirement for indigent individuals to also ensure that they have their free phone calls.
Just another follow-up. Thank you, through the chair. And there's no cost for in-person visitation other than the cost that DOC incurs by just having the staff available to have the visitation available. Is that a fair assessment?
Through the chair to Representative Carrick, I believe so. Other than staff time, that's a fair statement.
I would just make a comment, Mr. Chair. The sponsor statement of this legislation, which I do support, says that the bill enhances public safety and also alleviates financial strain linked with incarcerating repeat offenders. So in terms of a potential for education, connection with friends and family, the benefits for that towards recidivism reduction, seeing where that cost savings is. But Ms. Wilkerson, when you mentioned the potential cost savings for potentially alleviating some of the cost components to DOC of some of the services provided, that's a cost savings that's not mentioned as a benefit for this legislation. And I'll just say a statement. It just concerns me because I do think visitation in person that's freely available, or visitation over the phone that there are free phone calls available, a certain number, is really valuable. And the testimony we've heard suggests that there is potentially a cost associated with using these electronic communications. So more of a statement. I don't know if there's a response. But
I think I would follow up. Thank you. The department will continue to maintain those in-person visitation. This is an enhancement. It is not a replacement of our current operations.
Thank you. That's good reassurance.
Any additional questions from committee members? Representative Carpenter.
Thank you. And through the chair, in Alaska, who owns or who would own the actual iPad device or the tablet?
I'm not sure. Through the chair to Representative Carpenter, they are owned by ViaPath. We lease those. But I would like to defer to ViaPath to ensure that I made that statement correct.
I didn't quite catch that question. This is John Pilcher of iPath. I believe the question was the who pay or who owns those tablets or who pays for the tablets. Is that the question?
Yes, Mr. Pilcher. This is Representative Carpenter, and I was asking who actually owns the devices. I understand that they would be leased by the state, and they would be owned by your organization.
Correct. They would be provided by ViPath to the facility. They are still owned by ViPath at that point.
Follow up. is your model for paying for that lease something that inmates or their families are the only source of payment? I think I heard earlier there might be other organizations that would cover those costs as well, or potentially the state is on the hook for it. What's the model being used to pay for the leases?
Through the chair to Representative Carpenter, there is varying models, and depending on how this legislation goes and the RFP that is generated, that would really kind of set the tone. But currently in our pilot that we are doing, the DOC is paying those costs at the Highland Mountain facility.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Do you foresee the cost being shared to or shifted in any way to families? Or, I mean, inmates have a limited ability to raise funds because they're incarcerated, so conceivably the families are going to be picking up the cost. Is that part of the future here?
Through the chair to Representative Carpenter, it really depends on what the efforts are. And so, like with the telephone, what we negotiated with our phone provider is to provide a certain number of free calling per week. And that would be through the RFP and the negotiation process through the procurement. And so what I can envision, I don't know for 100%, where we would probably require a certain number of video visitations for free, depending on the situation. And then anything above and beyond that would probably be placed on the family or on the offenders.
Follow up. With regard to the actual devices and maintenance or upgrades that need to be done, is the state going to have somebody trained to produce maintenance efforts on the devices, or do they get mailed off to via PATH to do maintenance on?
Through the chair to Representative Carpenter, our intent is to ensure, just like with our phone provider, that the provider maintains, they do the updates, they do the maintenance. ViPath has come in and put in their own infrastructure, and they're maintaining that. We may have some quick on-hand troubleshooting that we assist them with, but it would be, they would be responsible for maintaining and updating.
Follow up. I guess it's a technical question for ViPath then. You just said that there was ROM stored operating system, so it's not like a traditional iPad. Software upgrades then, are you just removing a chip and putting in a new chip, or is it a software?
We do have software updates. Sorry, John Pilcher, ViPath again. We do have software updates that can be pushed over the air to update the tablets, much like you would with a commercial device. Again, all those are pushed out remotely.
Okay.
And Mr. Chair, this is Felicia Hall, if I may, just very quickly. It is not the desire of ViPath to implement a model whereby incarcerated individuals pay for our devices, them or their families pay for our devices. Of course, like the DOC representative said, that of course that will be hammered out through any RFP process, but just wanted you to hear from us, that is not a desired model where we require the incarcerated individuals to pay for devices.
Follow up.
Thank you. That's why we're here, right?
We have record follow-ups today.
I think I heard you say in the presentation there by ViPath, one of you did, that all of the communications are recorded on the device when inmates are using them. I assume that there's a way to distinguish between attorney-client privileged conversations and other conversations. And I see you nodding your heads. I'll give you a second to speak here in a second. But does that also mean that because things are being recorded, that both parties to the conversation are aware that that those conversations could be used against either party at some point in time for legal proceedings in the future.
Yes, John Pelcher of iPass again. Absolutely, there is a provision in there to mark someone as a professional visitor, and those would not be recorded. As for friends of family and inmate communications, yes, they would have a notification at the time that the call initiates, whether it's a phone call or a video visitation in our system. It notifies them that the call would be recorded or monitored.
Follow up.
Does the department have an assessment on whether their internet access to the facilities would need to be upgraded from what currently is being used if you've got an amount more than what you have now of Wi-Fi activity?
Through the chair to Representative Carpenter, absolutely it does. Our infrastructure is pretty old. That is something that we have worked with ViaPath. And as I mentioned previously, ViaPath came in and they brought in their own network and worked with I can't remember the vendor out in Eagle River to run a new line, and they installed their own infrastructure within the facility.
Mr. Chair,
follow up.
I think that's enough questions for me at the moment.
Okay, thank you. No more questions from committee members? No more follow-ups? Representative Story.
Sure. Thank you, Chair Shaw. And it might just help a little history with helping me understand how many businesses do work in correction systems, such as ViaPath. And when you did the pilot project, did you do an RFP with many other systems who work in this area and then came to select who we're using right now? If you could help me understand that.
Through the chair to Representative Story, absolutely. There's a few. So I'm aware of probably five different vendors that provide corrections grade tablets for Department of Corrections and for offenders' use. There are two that are currently on what we call the NASBO, the National Association of Procurement Officials, State Procurement Officials. And when a provider is on the NASBO list, the departments have the ability to coordinate with those providers to enter into contracts directly. And that's how we were able to enter directly into a contract with ViaPath for Hilo Mountain.
Thank you.
Oh, no additional questions from committee members? Okay, seeing none, we're going to set this bill aside for future consideration. But I'd also like to make note that the amendment deadline for HB 330 is Friday, April 5th. And with that, we will move on to the next presentation. House Bill 228, Mental Health Psychedelic Medical Task Force, sponsored by Representative Armstrong. House Bill 228 was given an initial hearing in this committee on March 14th. An amendment deadline was set, and my office only received one amendment. It's a friendly amendment at the request of the sponsor, and Representative Kerrick has agreed to carry and explain it. Representative Kerrick, would you like to move your amendment, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll move amendment number one.
Objection.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Amendment number one to House Bill 228 simply changes the name of the task force to make it clearer what the task force will be taking part in, and that they will not be taking a position on legalization, decriminalization, or medicalization of psychedelic drugs. We heard the testimony from the bill sponsor, and the new title just accurately describes the task force as being responsible only for considering what happens in Alaska after the FDA should potentially approve a psychedelic medicine and make statutory and regulatory recommendations to the legislature.
Thank you, Representative Kerrick. Representative Wright, you maintain your objection.
Brief at ease.
Now we'll open to public testimony on House Bill 228. Looks like we have brief at ease. Back on the record. Without objection and seeing none, the amendment number one has been adopted. I now open for public testimony on House Bill 228. Michael DeMolina, doctor from Wisdom Tradition Counseling, looks like you're online. Would you like to introduce yourself and provide your testimony, please?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, I'm Dr. Michael DeMolina. I'm a veteran, U.S. Army, dedicated citizen of Alaska for 35 years. I'm a graduate of the U.S. Army Academy of Health Sciences, and I was a medic and trained as a behavioral science specialist by the U.S. Army. So I've been treating trauma all the way back since the late 1980s. I've introduced myself to the committee before, and primarily I'm here to answer any questions that anyone might have. Just as a reminder, I put myself into this program at the California Institute of Integral Studies, which is most likely going to be the certification program that the FDA is going to approve once those regs come out, or if those regs come out. And so I do have some information that might be helpful to the committee. I am supportive of HB 228 because it just simply puts Alaska ahead of the curve if the FDA does medicalize MDMA as soon as this August.
Is that your testimony, Mr. DeMolina?
I can go on with some written things with the permission of the chair. I'll just say that my expertise is in trauma and addictions, our clinic that is celebrating our 19th year. That's what we do, trauma and addictions. I served as a substance use counselor in the Army. I worked at two major hospitals in the state of Alaska before I started with them, mid-level management positions and other big hospitals. And I've become an expert on PTSD, combat PTSD, but also trauma of all different sorts. And I have expertise in several different systems, such as brain spotting, eye movement integration, reconsolidation of traumatic memories was just on Jake Tapper on CNN last week. And so I've taken all of those courses, and I still stand before the committee saying that I would support HB 228 because it brings something else to the table in regard to trauma. And there's also a possibility if there is no task force, then there could be a problem in the state if there's no task force because there would be no guidelines. And so that's why I'm putting myself here to answer anyone's questions that they might have in regard to this topic.
Thank you, Mr. DeMolina. Is there anyone else in the room that would like to testify on behalf of House Bill 228? With that, I will close public testimony. If anyone would like to submit their testimony, please do so by emailing houseaffairs@alaskaledge.gov. Representative Armstrong, would you like to come forward and provide any wrap-up comments before I look at the will of the committee?
Thank you, everyone. For the record, Representative Jenny Armstrong. I just want to thank everyone for taking so much time to hear this bill. At the end of the day, our goal is to safely maximize the benefit of these medicines for Alaska. There are many prescriptions that are controversial, everything from birth control to painkillers, and even ibuprofen can be controversial sometimes. So I just want to remind folks that this is not something where we are here to defend or promote or take a position on psychedelics. Rather, this is something that is coming. The clinical trials on this began 20 years ago. And so I think perhaps even if you are a little nervous or you are unsure, that is the reason we want to have a task force. This medicine, unlike the average of 43 that are approved by the FDA every year, is something that is a little bit more heightened and getting a little bit more attention. And I think that it deserves a thorough conversation, both to understand implications around licensing. As Dr. DeMolina mentioned, he is currently in California finishing that certification that will likely become the FDA standard for this. And how will the state, we have a lot of latitude in how we determine how that licensing will go as well. So I just think that this is a great opportunity. It can have a really, really huge impact on Alaskans. And I appreciate everyone's consideration for this bill.
Thank you, Representative Armstrong. I always appreciate the energy you bring to the table. We have any comments from committee members? Representative Story.
Yes, thank you, and I appreciate that you are looking forward to our state handling this well. And if you can just tell me, the task force members that you chose, the makeup of the committee, and why you felt this was the important members of the task force.
Of course. Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Story, there are 16 slots on the task force. And I think, as I mentioned in a previous hearing, we've spent well over a year coordinating and talking to different groups and departments in the administration on this. So we have first up the first three members of the committee, Commissioner of Health or Commissioner Designee, and then same thing for Military and Veterans Affairs, Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. For Commissioner of Health, I think for that it's just because this is a medicine, so it partly falls under that. I've been pretty clear that this is not a public health bill, but we have met with several folks in the Department of Health, and I think having their perspective and a well-rounded perspective on the committee is really helpful. Military and Veterans Affairs, as I've discussed, we have the highest number of veterans per capita, and they've really led the charge on this at the federal level and have played a large role in the clinical trials. And then the rest, I don't want to go through all 16, but, you know, we have folks who represent the mental health issues in the state, two members from the Alaska Native Health Board, a psychiatrist, a member who represents the healthcare needs of survivors of domestic violence and sexual assault, that just bringing it back to the fact that we have the highest rate of women killed by men, some of the highest rates of sexual violence and sexual assault and domestic violence in the country. And again, those many of those victims end up having PTSD, which can then be treated by psychedelic medicine. And then the rest of the folks are from the medical profession, and then a member of the Senate, a member of the House, and then really important to me, page 2, line 31, three members selected by the task force once assembled. And that's because there is so much that we are learning day by day. The FDA only gave the priority review for this application just last month, or technically in February now. And so we want to make sure that this task force has the flexibility to bring in other folks as they deem appropriate as their work gets underway, especially given the short time frame. We want to make sure that they can have all the expertise at the table as they dive into creating the policy recommendations for the legislature.
Thank you.
Okay. Any additional comments from committee members? Seeing none, Representative Wright, can I have a motion, please?
Chair Shaw, I move House Bill 228, Work Order 33LS0976P, as amended from committee, with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal note.
And Steve, no objection. House Bill 228 moves from committee. We're going to take a brief at ease while we complete the committee report and prepare for our next presentation. House Bill 190, Alaska Sunset Commission, sponsored by Representative Carpenter. It was initially introduced by the committee on March 12th. Today, the bill sponsor has arranged for Eric Beverly from the Texas Sunset Commission to join us via Teams to speak to the committee about the process and take committee questions. Representative Carpenter, would you please lay the foundation for today's presentation, introduce yourself, and if your staff is needed, she can introduce herself as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is Representative Carpenter, represent District 8 on the Northern Kenai Peninsula. And my staff, we'll introduce her as well.
Donna Ardwin, staff to Representative Carpenter.
So the purpose of House Bill 190 is to do what most organizations struggle to do on a daily basis, which is get better. Our day-to-day operations consume so much of our time that it's hard to get to those things where we notice that something's not working exactly right, or it's taking too long, or it's too costly, but we just don't have the time to get to finding a solution. That is the nature of bureaucracy in general. That just happens. And House Bill 190 is a way that we can improve Alaskans' workplaces in state government, and also where the public interfaces with the state government on the services and things that they rely on state government through basically a third-party review, if you consider that the executive branch promulgates regulations and the legislature creates statutes, and both of those together give us programs and things that state government does. A third-party review would be created underneath the lieutenant governor, and we would title it the Alaska Sunset Commission. And that commission was modeled after the Texas Sunset Commission that's been in place for a number of years. 1977 was when it was created and has existed since then. And Eric Mr. Beverly. Mr. Eric Beverly is the executive director of the Sunset Advisory Commission for the state of Texas. And he is with us here today. I think he's maybe 3 hours ahead of us in time. So I would like to get to him without much further ado and hear what he has to say about what the Texas Sunset Commission has done for the state of Texas.
Thank you, Representative Carpenter. Mr. Beverly, I see the executive director for the Alaska Sunset Advisory Commission. Could you please introduce yourself and provide your testimony, please?
Good afternoon, Chairman Shaw, Vice Chair Wright, and members of the House State Affairs Committee. For the record, my name is Eric Beverly. I am the executive director of the Texas Sunset Advisory Commission, which is a nonpartisan legislative agency with a mission and focus on objective analysis to improve state government. I'm joined by Emily Johnson, who is our deputy director for reviews. Thank you for the opportunity to be with you this afternoon. Created in 1977, the Texas Sunset Commission evaluates state agencies and decides whether to keep them, and if so, how to fix problems found with these agencies and improve their operations using changes to state law as well as management actions. State agencies in Texas typically undergo sunset review every 12 years, although the legislature can and does alter the frequency of a review for a particular agency. And the Sunset Commission bases its evaluations on criteria established in state statute, such as whether the agency is achieving its statutory objectives, operating efficiently and cost effectively, and encouraging public participation. The sunset process has streamlined and changed government in Texas. Since sunset's inception, 95 agencies have been abolished, including 42 agencies that were completely abolished and 53 that were abolished with certain functions being transferred to existing or new agencies. In doing so, Sunset has garnered $1 billion in state and federal savings and revenue gains, resulting in a return on investment of $16 for every $1 invested and appropriated to the Sunset Commission since 1985. While abolishment of an agency or program is often what people focus on, the sunset process also shines a light on an agency, letting the legislature take a hard look at its operations, oftentimes finding practices that have not been updated over time or that do not conform to best practices, particularly on licensing and regulatory matters. For some agencies outside of the appropriations process, sunset is the only time that the legislature is able to devote its full attention to the needs of the agency and the needs of its stakeholders. The sunset process has led to major improvements in nearly every area of state government here in Texas. We have abolished unnecessary state agencies and programs, lowered state expenditures, and modernized outdated state laws. We have reduced state regulation of businesses and occupations while continuing to protect the public and providing a more equitable path to working in Texas. And we have eliminated duplication among state agencies and program, increased public participation and government accountability, and improved the quality, consistency, and efficiency of state government services. I'd like to share just a few examples of results of the sunset process over time, broken out by key policy area. With regard to transportation, since the late 1990s, the Texas Department of Transportation has undergone sunset review multiple times, resulting in a number of additional financing methods for transportation projects and improvements to how TxDOT conducts its business. Sunset's recommendations have led to better monitoring of highway contracts, strengthened internal controls, improved public involvement, and a more integrated and understandable transportation planning process. With regard to energy and natural resources, Sunset's review of our Public Utility Commission of Texas led to the creation of the Office of Public Utility Counsel to advocate for small ratepayers in rate case proceedings. The review of the state's environmental regulator improved timeliness of enforcement action against polluters. Sunset's review of the state's oil and gas regulator brought about increased funding for oil field cleanup and well plugging, and strengthen financial security requirements of oil and gas operators to reduce the state's liability for pollution and abandoned wells. With regard to Health and Human Services, in 2015, following the Sunset Commission's review of the state's Health and Human Services system, including the five departments that comprised that system at the time, the legislature passed the Sunset Bill that consolidated Health and Human Services in Texas. This reorganization led to improved oversight of the system's administrative functions by requiring more high-level oversight throughout the system and escalating attention on large and problematic contracts. The legislation also integrated services for clients by requiring consolidation of basic front door assessment, screening, and referral for mental health and substance abuse services, and by consolidating two women's health programs to reduce burdens on clients, providers, and the state. The Sunset legislation also streamlined burdensome processes related to Medicaid provider payment holds for fraud and simplified public interactions with the system by coordinating and consolidating HHSC ombudsman services and system websites and hotlines. While the Sunset Commission is geared toward achieving cost savings for the state, the Commission's other charge to improve the operations of state government occasionally requires a fiscal impact remedy. And this past legislative session was one of those rare occasions. Sunset recommendations for the Texas Juvenile Justice Department and the Public Utility Commission of Texas last session included appropriative recommendations for funding to increase the capacity of juvenile justice facilities, address chronic staff retention issues, and improve oversight of the state's electric and water utility industries. As I wrap up, I should mention I sit before you today as the previous beneficiary of the Sunset process, as I have twice served as a liaison for state agencies under Sunset Review, and I also served as the director of field inspections and the deputy executive director for licensing services at the Texas Department of Licensing and Regulation prior to accepting my current position. Sunset's review of my former agency, TDLR, led to streamlined licensing, better use of limited resources through data-driven risk-based inspections, which I implemented when I was in that role, and the elimination of unneeded programs, which freed up resources for agency and legislative priorities. Lastly, a critical part of the Sunset process is that it's not just Sunset staff and members who get to weigh in on the agency's operations. The public gets to give testimony and bring forth their own ideas on how to make the agency under review better. Additionally, the establishment of an agency's sunset date in statute, which is a date on which that agency will expire unless continued by the legislature, ensures that the legislature takes action on the Sunset Commission's findings and recommendations to continue the agency. The end product of the Sunset process is legislation designed to position an agency to effectively and efficiently serve the citizens of Texas now and in the future. Thank you, Chairman Shaw, Vice Chair Wright, members of the committee for giving me the opportunity to speak with you today. That concludes my remarks, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Beverly. Next, we have Emily Johnson online, Deputy Director for Reviews, Alaska Sunset Advisory Commission. If you'd like to place your name on the record and provide your testimony, please.
I do not have any testimony, Emily Johnson, Deputy Director for Reviews with the Texas Sunset Advisory Commission.
We appreciate that. Thank you. Questions from committee members. Representative Carrick.
Thank you, Chair Shaw. There will be one question for this bill. I'm just curious, and thank you for your testimony, Mr. Beverly. Prior to the Texas Sunset Commission, was there any agency-wide operational auditing and reports prepared for the Texas state legislature? Was there anything, in other words, similar to the legislative audit that we utilize in Alaska for the entire agency?
Right. In Texas, we do have a state auditor's office, and we also have a legislative budget board. And I, Emily, you correct me if I'm wrong, but I think both of those entities predate Sunset. So,
yes, there was the Sunset's shop was sort of built into our legislative budget board for a period of time. And so there was sort of a performance evaluative component there, but not in its as it exists in its current form.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I thought I could do it in one. Thank you for that answer. And was it within the scope, to your knowledge, of that legislative audit process to do an agency-wide audit? So the Sunset Commission has teeth built into it, mm-hmm. And that's kind of the added piece of scope that we're adding with this legislation, or one of the added pieces. Is an agency-wide audit something that the Texas version of that had prior to the Texas Sunset Commission?
So I don't know the practices of the state auditor's office back in the 1970s. Unfortunately, I'm not familiar with their practices at that time.
Representative Story.
Thank you, Chair Shaw. Through the chair to Mr. Beverly. I believe your commission is made up of 10 state lawmakers and a couple members of the public. Is that accurate?
That is correct. The lieutenant governor appoints 5 members, the speaker of the House that are senators, and 1 public member. And the speaker of the House of Representatives appoints 5 state representatives and 1 public member, for a total of 12 members. The legislative members serve 4-year terms, and the public members serve 2-year terms.
Follow up.
Can you tell me why you used the commission used state lawmakers as members of the commission? This bill before us uses people from private industry, so I'm wondering why Texas chose to go with state lawmakers.
Emily, do you have any insights on the original decision-making?
No, not historical context. The most I would say, or I think it's probably what you would say, which is there is a piece of legislation that comes out of the sunset process. And so the members of our commission typically carry those bills. But historically, I don't have good context for why they went that route, except that it probably made sense given what they were setting up.
Follow up.
And then I'm trying to remember if it's a PowerPoint I saw, but I don't believe you or the commission looks at the university system there, or do they? And why? Why not? Follow up, sorry.
Typically, our reviews are limited to executive branch agencies. Universities and courts are exempt from review. But we do look at, for example, we'll look at the Texas Higher Education Coordinating Board, which is an executive branch state agency. Emily, do you have something to add?
There's also a couple of unique things within higher education that the agents that Sunset has reviewed in the past are Forest Service is attached to one of our institutions of higher education, and the legislature has placed other components under special review under Sunset that are built within our higher education systems on occasion.
Thank you.
No additional questions from committee members. Thank you, Mr. Beverly and Ms. Johnson, for your presentation.
Thank you.
No additional questions? Seeing none. A deadline was set in my office for 3 amendments were sponsored by Representative Carrick. And Representative Story.
Thank you, Chair Shaw. I wanted to ask you, Rep. Carpenter, why you chose for the makeup of the commission to use all outside people.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Storrs, Representative Carpenter. One of the things that I thought was important going into this was trying to keep it as apolitical as possible. If we want to have continuity between election cycles, putting people in charge or with the responsibility to conduct the business of the Alaska Sunset Commission that weren't elected leaders helped depoliticize what could be political issues when you're talking about restructuring or making improvements to state government. And so putting people in place that truly want to and have the subject matter expertise to look into the financial issues, budget analysis, counting, operations management, those subject matter experts. I mean, just because you get elected doesn't mean you have experience in any of those areas.
we would really truly want to have the subject matter experts looking into our state government and not in a political manner, which I think if you put legislators in that mix might increase the risk that you have political outcomes.
How about the university? You have the university listed, and I believe the testifier before has talked about complex system, and just wondering if you had any thoughts on that.
Thank you, Rep. Story, Rep. Carpenter again. Through the chair, I think that the it would be interesting to see a comparison between the Texas higher education system and their funding structure compared to the funding structure for the Alaska higher education system. I don't know whether it's an apples to apples comparison. Much of our higher education system in Alaska is funded through state budget. Even though it's a land grant university and should, in my opinion, and this is again where the politics come into play, but in my opinion, they should stand more on their own being a land grant university of generating the revenue necessary and less on state government. To the extent that they are funded like another department within the government, makes sense to me that we would want them to operate as efficiently as possible with respect to state budgets.
Follow up, if I might.
Follow up.
Okay, thank you. I'm just looking at this, and it seems like any commissioner from outside industry who is serving, they who is in a state or elected representative, they have a lot of legal privileges, including like attorney-client privileges. And I'm wondering, that's giving a lot of power to the commissioners. Have you seen any legal liabilities for that or any problems with that?
I guess the real quick answer would be no. I guess that's a good philosophical conversation to have. We're creating statute that is giving the right and left limits for the commissioners and what their authorities are and are not. And so I guess if there are concerns that we're granting too much authority to the commissioners, then we would just make a decision that they have less authority. But again, what we're trying to get at is subject matter experts helping the state government improve what it is the state government does. In some cases, that is doing things better. In some cases, that might be more or less funding is the result that we get to. So I'm not sure. I mean, maybe. Yeah, I'm not sure how to answer that question other than how I have. Do you have anything else to add?
Donna Ardwin for the record. Just to add to that, the only authority being given to the commission is the authority to provide a report and draft legislation to the legislature. So they're not acting on their own in terms of abolishing a commission, a department, or an entity.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I think I'd follow up and just say that my overall intent was not to abolish departments. That isn't the intent of the commission. It is just the way in the bill to provide teeth that causes us to take the recommendation seriously. That's the whole point of that piece of it. So to the extent that we don't take the recommendation seriously, that would be the extent of their power, because they can provide recommendations and then we can just ignore them.
A follow-up. Thank you. On page 5, line 3-7, it does give them access to a lot of inspection of records and documentation and a lot of private information that, I mean, obviously anyone who we would pick on the commission you'd think would have confidentiality and all those things. But I just note that because it gives me pause.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Story, legislative auditor and staff have a similar level of authority with regard to the audits that we currently do within the state. And I don't see this as drastically different from that, other than the recommendations are coming from public members of the public, and there's teeth in them for the legislature and the executive branch to have to do something with the recommendation.
One more follow-up. Final follow-up. So that just brings me to, and Rep. Carrick brought up something about that of our current state auditor, and we get findings on our audits. And I'm oftentimes concerned that we don't have a formal process, it seems to me, unless one legislature really looks deeply and sees the concern and brings it to the department, and that we're changing our practices because of our audits. And that's worrisome. And when I look at the commission, it seems that in part of it, it's kind of a way to try and correct that, that we're not doing as good a follow through as we should with our audits. At least that's my opinion. And I know when I look at the fiscal note with the commission, it's expensive to invest in a commission, and we want to have cost savings from it. But have you looked at all about improving our auditing process as, you know, something that we should be doing?
As an alternative, through the chair, Representative Story, yeah. Yes, as an alternative to this, improving what the auditor does. And I think that it's something that's not replacing the function of the state auditor. It is in addition to. The state auditor is still going to have things that periodically come up within state government during legislative session and outside of legislative session that the legislature says, hey, we want to take a look at. And so there's a purpose for the state auditor and the state auditor staff that is separate from the process improvement and the deep dive into government agencies that really you would have two different, that they're two different missions.
I guess I have one more follow-up if I may.
Your follow-ups are going to be audited.
Okay. Yeah, I was just saying, I think it's important that we look at our current auditing process, and I don't think it's so much the task of the auditor to make sure that we follow up and look into recommendations and policies that is being provided to us. And so I just think that's a task that I would hope we would get a better process on.
And thank you, Representative Story, and through the chair. I'm not in disagreement. I know that there are plenty of audits that come out that don't ever have an impact. And I know that that is some level of frustration with the auditor.
Yeah. If I may, for the record, Donna Ardwin, the auditor, state auditor, conducts financial audits. You had since 2013 in statute the ability for them to conduct, they actually contracted out for performance review audits. That legislation sunset last year because it wasn't being utilized by the legislature. That's one of the reasons for our interest in this commission and being run as it is.
Thank you. It's good we have follow-ups on the audits. No additional questions. My office received three amendments, all sponsored by Representative Carrick. Representative Carrick, would you like to offer your amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to offer, because they're not numbered, Amendment S.1.
Objection for purposes of discussion.
Okay, questions and answers, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually really appreciate the thorough conversation that was just had on the record. I think that gets to kind of the maybe difference of opinion that I may have with the bill sponsor regarding kind of the function that is hoping to be performed by a sunset commission and our current legislative audit process. I do think just from some of the statements just made, it actually clarifies in my mind that a good place to start with the intention of the legislation would be to request audits from Legislative Audit Division and bring back those performance review audits, because we should have followed them. I would agree that that's a valuable resource. And it sounds like the functions and data collection we would get from the Sunset Commission would be largely similar to our Legislative Audit Division findings if it included still those performance review measures. Amendment number S.1 essentially continues the Sunset Commission, allows its establishment, and deletes reference to preparing draft legislation. So on page 4, line 29 of the legislation, it does say that the powers and duties of the commission include prepare a report and draft legislation. So draft legislation would be removed. The Sunset Commission, in other words, would still prepare a report about the review activities they've conducted and would consider whether there's public need for continuation of an entity. All of the functions of the Sunset Commission would continue to be in place, but a report would be prepared instead of, as the bill sponsor mentioned, adding those teeth. And I'm also offering this amendment because I'm deeply of the opinion that when we get legislative audit findings, we should do something about them. I'm just extremely wary of adding those teeth into statute, considering some of the political factors and concerns mentioned. I think that that's a very relevant concern, and adding that each draft, that draft legislation will be submitted for introduction into each House Rules Committee, gives me great pause. So those would be my comments on S.1.
Representative Wright.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to hear from the bill sponsor in regards to this amendment.
Thank you, through the chair. So the purpose of the Sunset Commission from the legislature's point of view is to hire subject matter experts to dive down into our departments and provide recommendations for how to improve the state government. They're the ones that are closest to the recommendations that would come forward in the form of a change to regulation or a change to statute. And those subject matter experts, it would be, if we amended this with Amendment S.1, would be like putting those subject matter experts with a requirement to produce a report, but withhold the recommendation that is actually the language change that would be necessary. So describe the language change in the report, but don't actually provide the language change. So I think that it would be in our best interest to have the report come forward with recommended language that the legislature then takes action on. They can amend it as they need to. They can do whatever the legislative process does with regard to bills that get drafted and, you know, put forward by the executive branch, by members of the legislature. So I don't see this as a help to the Sunset Commission. It would actually cause us to have more work of interpreting their results, and somebody would then have to create a bill with the recommended language. Why not have the people who you just paid to provide the recommendations create the language?
Follow-ups? Questions? Representative Story?
Thank you, Chair Shaw. I actually think that a lot of people serving in industry, and it's good that I don't know if I would have them draft the legislation. They could give some. I think that this might be setting them up for some unrealistic expectations that they can do within the legislature, the people from industry. And I tend to support this this amendment.
Representative Carpenter?
Yeah, thank you. Through the chair to Representative Story. The subject matter expertise are the individuals I guess I should have started by saying the individuals with subject matter expertise are the ones that are doing the heavy lifting, but they have staff that are with them that are going to help with the report writing and the draft legislation. So it's not just the individuals that would be appointed. There's going to be staff that are going to help facilitate their work.
Thank you. Representative Wright, do you maintain your objection?
I do.
With that, we're going to be taking a roll call vote. Would you take a roll call vote, please? I'm sorry.
Brief at ease?
Brief at ease.
I don't think you have to, unless you want to.
Unless you want to. Okay.
So, Nick. Can we have a brief at ease?
Brief at ease, got it. Brief. The record. Would the secretary recall the roll, please?
Representative Carpenter.
No.
Representative Johnson is not here. Representative Allard is not here. Representative Carrick.
Yes.
Representative Story.
Yes.
Representative Wright.
No.
Chair Shaw.
No.
2 yeas, 3 nays.
And with a vote of 3 nays and 2 yeas, amendment number 1 fails. Let's see here. Representative Carrick.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to offer Amendment S.2.
Objection for purpose of discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Amendment S.2, I think, gets to a question or a comment that Representative Story brought up earlier about the composition of the Sunset Commission. I would just offer the brief anecdote that even during this last operating budget process, we were here in this, largely this committee membership for the Department of Administration subcommittee, and we heard from, in a joint hearing, the payroll division on some issues facing the department. And in follow-up to some of those payroll division issues, another member of the House and I were able to sit down and talk about with employees, direct employees of the payroll division, some of those serious challenges and come to some different conclusions than was initially provided by departments. So I think that that provides just a basic example of how employees of our agencies can often be the best canaries in the coal mine, if you will, of serious efficiency issues and challenges, significant needs, whether those are for more or less funding, which I know the sponsor of the bill has talked about as being a potential outcome in either direction of the Sunset Commission recommendations. So essentially what Amendment S.2 does is it adds 4 additional positions that would be from the department or agency. This gives more say and allows for that important inside perspective on the operations of that department or agency. I think that so long as we're spending approximately $1.1 to $2 million a year to have a Sunset Commission to operate it and to get those findings, we may as well ensure that we're having appropriate representation to get the findings. So this amendment simply offers those closest to the current processes in our agencies some decision-making authority and sway, not a majority sway, but some sort of input formally on the commission.
Representative Wright, do you maintain your objection?
Yes, I do. Actually, I would like to hear from the bill sponsor on this.
Representative Carpenter?
Through the chair to Representative Wright. Legislative auditor is able to do the auditor's job now, and when we were doing performance audits, was able to do the performance audits without having members of the administration become members of the auditing committee or the process that we do the audits. So I think that this would complicate matters more than help. And I think Ms. Ardwin has a comment.
Donna Ardwin for the record. If I could also add, like the Texas Commission, the process includes the first thing that happens when an entity is up for review, the state entity puts together a report to the commission. So they start by self-reporting what they think their issues, their problems, their highlights, things that could be improved upon. So that's the first step in this process.
And I would just finish that by saying that this isn't meant to be a one-sided conversation. It's supposed to be an interactive conversation with the departments on getting, like, departments know what's broken. They just lack the ability sometimes to get to it because of budget constraints, personnel restraints, time restraints, and we need their input. The bill as it's currently drafted solicits that input before we even get started. So I'm not in favor of the amendment.
Thank you, Representative Carpenter. Representative Story?
I actually think this is a really important amendment because just like the Texas Commission, they really do have some people who are involved in the, you know, overseeing the work involved. And so I think it's important.
Before we take a vote, would you like to do a wrap up?
Thank you. Yes, Mr. Chair. I think the other just important point to make here is that the members of the departments or agencies involved would be appointed by the commissioner or the president of the university system. And so this somewhat helps to ensure that the administration is actually, to the bill sponsor's intent, kind of being represented and that continues not just through the preparation of an initial report, but through the whole process. And so, again, might just be a difference of opinion, but I think that this is an incredibly important way to ensure we're getting the closest folks to the decision-making process in the room at the table, assisting with providing those efficiency recommendations.
Thank you, Representative Carrick.
I maintain my objection.
Thank you. Well, with House Directors, I'd like to take a roll call vote, please.
Representative Wright?
No.
Representative Carpenter?
No.
Representative Johnson is not here. Representative Allard is not here. Representative Carrick?
Yes.
Representative Story?
Yes.
Chair Shaw?
No.
Two yeas, three nays.
And with a vote of three nays and two yeas, amendment number two has failed. Amendment number three, Representative Carrick.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I move amendment S.3.
Objection.
Representative Carrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Last amendment that I have here for the Sunset Commission simply changes the frequency of review. So I had some of the same concerns about apolitical, the nature of the Sunset Commission being apolitical. And I mean, I think that was brought up as reasons for some of the composition of the Sunset Commission, but I do think the timing is also a really important consideration. The current legislation says that we will have these sunset reviews brought forward with draft legislation every year. So those will include both odd years when we have a new, fresh legislature, and even years when we are, as all of us know, a much more political session heading into the potential for turnover in the next legislature. So this legislation changes that time frame for review from 1 year to every other year. The other thing that this helps to accomplish is giving time for the legislature to act on those recommendations. I wanted to make sure the amendment was really specific to say that we would have those draft legislation and reports completed in the odd years so that there would be a two-year process for the legislature to act on those recommendations, especially when we're talking about auditing entire agencies. There's a lot to chew on there for both the commission and for the members of the legislature. So unlike some of our smaller boards and commissions where there may be just one or two smaller recommendations, we could likely anticipate per the Sunset Review Commission in Texas that there might be some really significant changes to act upon and significant policy discussions. So the other piece to me is to ensure that there's time for the legislature to work on this process of having those bills move forward potentially, and also still having time to work on the many other things that come before the body. So with that, I would ask for folks' support.
Representative Wright?
I'd like to hear from the bill sponsor. I think this kind of takes away from the spirit of the bill. I think folks coming in and being elected to office, you came here for a reason, and I think every year you need to be taking your time and going through this process and understanding what needs to go and what needs to stay. I mean, I think sunsets are important, and I think the bill sponsor may have a little bit more to speak on it eloquently about it.
Rep. Carpenter?
Well, I'm not sure whether I'll be eloquent, Mr. Chair. I guess the way that I would respond to this is that the legislature currently has the time. It just lacks the will to do what it is that we're trying to get at with this bill. So more time just gives more time of delay and avoiding a difficult conversation. A lot can be accomplished with a focused team in a 12-month period. And I don't foresee that any one of our departments are so complex and so deep that some level of recommendations can't be made in a 12-month period with a small group of people that don't have distractions of all of the different bills that come before us every year. They're focused on specifically their statutory responsibilities and the particular department that they're looking at that year, not all of the other departments, like what we have to consider on a session-wide basis. They're on that 12-month period, that year that they're looking, they're just focused on one department. And within 12 months, they should be able to provide a recommendation to the legislature. I would rather err on the side of caution of requiring the legislature to take action when recommendations are provided, not
extend the time for inaction.
Can I add through the chair, Donna Ardwin, for the record, as the folks from Texas pointed out, they do a review every year, and so they have agencies being reviewed every 12 years. If we went every other year, you would go but like 20 years between reviews of any agency. Also, I wanted to point out that at the Ways and Means Committee, this was actually amended. It had been 1 year, and now it says at least, and that was because that committee felt that some agencies are very small, and they could be done less than a year. Some might take more than a year. So they wanted to put some flexibility in that time schedule.
Thank you. You maintain your objection?
Mr. Chair.
A wrap-up on Amendment 3?
Very brief wrap-up, Mr. Chair. I'm, as an anecdote, currently carrying the TVAP reauthorization. I just want to note to the bill sponsor's comments that that legislation is not an agency review. It's not a full department review. It's actually a fairly simple program, very straightforward. And we had an audit that we asked for with recommendations prepared. And it is appearing to me through the committees of referral that what I've been frequently told from members is that it's too complicated to address the recommendations of the audit in that reauthorization legislation in this year. So I do think on a practical level, while what's been said is valiant and I would on a principled level agree with it, I think in practicality, with many of our boards and commission sunsets and with legislation that I've now worked on the past three reauthorizations, I just have not seen that in practice. And so I want to ensure that there's adequate time for the legislature to be able to truly address the recommendations that come forward, especially as they would come forward in legislation with the current bill and the committee not adopting the first S.1 amendment. So,
Representative Wright, you maintain your objection?
I do maintain my objection.
With that, could House Records take a roll call vote, please?
Representative Story?
Yes.
Representative Wright?
No.
Representative Carpenter?
No.
Representative Johnson is not here. Representative Allard is not here. Representative Carrick?
Yes.
Chair Shaw?
No.
2 yeas, 3 nays.
And with a vote of 3 nays and 2 yeas, Amendment number 3 has failed. That concludes the consideration of our amendments. At this time, we're going to open it up to public testimony. I see no one in the room. I see no one online. We are going to close public testimony. And if there is any testimony you'd like to be, come to my office in writing, please do so to House State Affairs, housestate.affairs@akledge.gov. We're going to be holding this bill over for further consideration. That concludes today's, would you like to do any follow-up? Okay. That concludes today's House State Affairs Committee meeting. I see no other business before the committee. We are adjourned at 4:52.